हरि को चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरिगौर भक्त वृंद हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
ओके सो इशुपनिषद देन. So this is basically broken into sambandha, abhideya, and prayojana. So it's based off of the Tattva Vivek, no, Tattva Sutra, of Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur. So that is taking the Vedic, or let's say the Upanishadic principle of the chit achit ishwara, your process and your result. So chit achit ishwara will be sambandha, your process will be abhideya, your result will be prayojana. So here then we see we have topic 1, 2, and 3. So that'll be in part 1 of sambandha. The topic 4 will be abhideya, and the topic 5 will be prayojana. So 1 is the nature of Brahman, 2nd and 3rd are the nature of the soul and their relationship to Brahman. Then topic 4, the means of attaining Brahman, and 5, the nature of the supreme goal of the jiva in mukti. Okay. So that'll be the book, and then in the appendix is a thematic overview by Atma Tattva. Yes.
In Bhagavad Gita, the result corresponds to karma.
Yeah, you could say. Yeah, because time would be abhideya. But there, then, it's that example is giving, it covers that, but it's showing how karma is the thing that's temporary, because that's what has to change. So we see there, if we put it in the nature of result, then that's what has to change, because our results for ourself, therefore it's material. Because the relationship of the soul, God, the material world stays the same. Time is still endeavor. That stays the same. But what changes is the goal. The goal being that the results for Krishna. So then, therefore, karma will stop. Because karma is only there because the endeavor is done for ourselves. If we do the endeavor for Krishna, it's not karma anymore. Does that make sense? Because time, the soul, God, the material energy are eternal. So karma is the temporary element because the jiva being an illusion about his relationship with the Lord, that's a temporary thing. Right? And as soon as he understands this actual relationship, then the endeavors are spiritual, so there's no material result, so there's no karma. Does that make sense? So certain terms are used specifically in relationship to the material. Right? But if it's not material, they don't use that term. Right, we just say Krishna's pleasure or this or that, but if it's not for Krishna's pleasure, we call it karma. Or in the material world, we call it sense gratification. But engaging the senses in the Lord's service, we call that devotional service. Right? Because the result's for Krishna. So the endeavor of the senses, engaged with the sense objects, isn't the problem. It's when that endeavor is for your own purpose that it becomes sense gratification. Or when we are contemplating how to perform something in a situation, how to get the best results, then if that's for Krishna, that's manana, right? Or we say contemplation. If it's for ourselves, we call it mental speculation. Does that make sense? So sometimes we get so used to the term that we think that if the senses are engaged, it's sense gratification. Like sometimes I've heard devotees saying that, oh, you can't enjoy prasad. You know, the point is what you're tasting that you enjoy, that's Krishna. So it's a relationship with Krishna. So it's not that the soul won't be happy in relationship with Krishna. But it's not that you're eating the food just to enjoy. You're eating the food because it's relationship with Krishna. So then it's not sense gratification anymore. But we'll get things, oh, you can't enjoy, you can't be nice. We can't make a nice situation because that will be for our own enjoyment. Right? And so therefore, decorating, making everything nice, then all just starts to disappear. Serving prasad nice, well, that's all maya because we're just interested in eating. So everyone will just put it in the bucket and everyone will just come and get it when they want. In fact, because there's five preparations, that would be sense gratification. So we'll just mix them all together. You know, and then, you know, that would be, you know, all that sense gratification like that. So we'll just pour it out on the floor and everyone can just get down and eat it off the floor. You understand? It just goes in that direction. But we may say, no, but this is, you know, a renunciation. But then if that's the fact, then that means the Protestants are very renounced and the Catholics are gross sense gratifiers. Right? Because the Catholics believe in making a very beautiful temple, nice art, you know, nice music, all these different things, nice clothes, while the Protestants say none of that. So, in other words, it's a pretty common material perspective. Right? Does that make sense? It's not an uncommon thing. The path of material thinking follows specific routes. Right? We'll get into details of that next year. But it's specifically, it's, you know. In other words, we're discerning what's right and wrong now. You know, so we can see the point. But the actual, how the path unfolds, that we'll look at that next. Now we look more at how the devotional develops. Right, so when we're very clear the difference between material and spiritual, then you can analyze the material very nicely and understand, you know, it's just common, it's ordinary. We'll think it's special, unique, different, but no, it's everybody does it like that. Is that okay? Okay, so the introduction. So you have two pages, the introduction. The thematic study shows how the topics discussed in Sri Isha Upanishad fall into the categories of Vastutraya, right? It means Sambandhavideya and Prayojana. The five main topics of the Upanishads and the 10 esoteric truths of the Gaudiya Vaishnav philosophy, Dasamul Tattva. Right? Because that's our analyzation is actually Vastutraya. But when we expand that, then we get the five topics of the Upanishads. And when that's expanded out, then we get the 10 main topics. Right? And we'll see when we get to the Bhagavatam, then one of the studies will be how that expands. You know, those ones stay the same, but the evidence, Abhideya and Prayojana, those expand, so you actually get 20. But it's still based off of, you know, these main essentials. So it all still comes back to Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Right? So for Upanishads, because they don't get so much into the Abhideya and Prayojana, though they mention it, but it's still, so now we'll deal with the 10. Five main topics of the Upanishads are as follows. 1. The nature of Brahman, Ishvara. 2. The nature of the soul and its relationship to Brahman, Chit. The material energy, its origin and connection to Brahman, Achit. 4. The means of attaining Brahman, Sadhana. And 5. The nature of the supreme goal and the status of the Jiva in Mukti, Sadhya. Right, so you have sadhana, you have sadhya, and then there's one more. Sadhana, sadhya. No, maybe it'll come up later. But sadhana is the process, sadhya is who they're. Oh, sadhaka. I think it's sadhaka, sadhana, and sadhya. Right, so the sadhaka is the individual. Right, so they perform sadhana, and that attains the goal, sadhya, which is the Lord. The first three topics delineate Sambandha, the fourth defines Abhideya, and the fifth describes Prayojana. The thematic study shows how Sri Ashupanishad analyzes these five topics and resolves the different interpretations of other schools of Vedic philosophy. The Gaudiya Siddhanta is based on the teachings of the Upanishads and Vedanta Sutra. Therefore, it is not surprising that all tenets of our philosophy can be traced back to the five main topics of the Upanishads. In the third
year also, we will be studying the Chaitanya Shikshamrita, which is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's discussion of the Dasa Mool based on the Upanishads. So all evidences he gives are Upanishads. Even when he's talking about Prayojana and worship of Radha and Krishna, he still quotes Upanishads like that. So, and I think it's Srila Prabhupada makes the point there, or Jiva Goswami makes the point that unless you can take the philosophy back to the Upanishads, it's actually not bona fide. Right? So this idea is just, we don't worry about all these things. No, the Acharyas, they take it back to the Upanishads. That's why when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, there was coming up a discussion, there was a challenge about the Vaishnava philosophy and the Smarta philosophy. The first thing they said is you can't use Smriti. So anything other than the Vedas. And then he agreed. So they thought he wouldn't agree because, you know, he uses Gita and Bhagavatam and the Puranas, and so it's easy. So if we go back to the, you know, the Veda and the Upanishad, then he won't be able to. And he said, fine. They'll discuss the Upanishad. Then they said, you can only use the Vedic Samhita. And he said, fine. And so they canceled the discussion. Because they knew that it wasn't going to go well for them. So the point is even though the element of rasa, the element that we were saying before, the manobhav, the mood of the mind, the mood of the heart, is a very prominent, and you could say in its presentation, it's very unique in the Gaudiya line. It's not that the tattva and the siddhanta aren't as well established, that they go right back to the Upanishads, back to the Vedas. Regarding the first topic, the nature of Brahman, the central issue is whether Brahman is without characteristics. This is the impersonal concept called nirvishesh, or he has characteristics. That is the savishesh doctrine maintained by the Vaishnavas. Below is the specific answer to this as given in Dasamul Tattva. Because right? Brahman is the point, is that we have to be able to discuss on the Brahman platform. Generally, devotees, oh, Brahman, that's Mayavada. No, Brahman simply means that the substance of the creation is transcendence. Right? It's non-different from the Lord. So we say the creation comes from Krishna. It's his energy. That means it actually has to be Brahman. So he's Brahman, his energies are Brahman. It's the same substance, just he's unlimited, and they have their specifics. They're either dependent or temporary or, you know, all these different other elements. Minute, we're very minute. So the three energies, then they have something that is, they are dependent upon the Lord, while he is independent. Right? So we can discuss him as Brahman, so we don't have a problem with that. So that this also is, if we understand the Upanishad here, that if you're ever discussing in circles where it's like yoga or other kind of like new agey elements, you just discuss from this platform. No one will have a problem. Right? To see is, when it comes to philosophy, no one has a problem with, you know, Brahman like that. There isn't anybody that has a problem, right? Maybe the Buddhists, but then, okay, they're kind of the nothingness like this, so you get into that. But the point is Brahman's not a problem. And then of those who accept that element, there's also those who, you know, believe in God. So then the personal is also open for discussion. But the basis is this element of Brahman. So it's always something you can use, right? Just the difference is, Savishesh or Nirvishesh. Yeah.
How can we understand systematically where how far we can give our presentation. Like, to Christians, if we bring Bhagavan at some point...
That, you generally talk about love of God. That's the problem. God is a... We're a person. You know, our endeavor is to, you know, please Him. You know, His arrangements so that we can do that, His support, these kind of things. Because that aspect will go, but if you go into what does God look like, what does He do, that's where it falls apart and turns into the impersonal. But up to that point, as long as you don't think about it too much, then it's fine. You know, and other new agey things, then, you know, Brahman works great for them. But we're not talking the Nirvishesh Brahman that they're thinking about. We're talking about Savishesh Brahman. So we're talking about Krishna. But just Krishna as Brahman. Because he's Sat, Chit, and Ananda. Right? So he is Sat, so that means he is Brahman. But there's also Chit and Ananda. But, you know, but you, if they won't accept it as one package, you start with that. So it's something that, and they'll progress. And then as they go, then you start to add in things and then bring in Chit and then bring in Ananda. Does that make sense? Nirvishesh and Savishesh. Visesh means specialness. So Nirvishesh means no specialness, means no quality. Savishesh means with specialness. Right? So here is then his answer in Dasamutattva. One, the Vedas are the principal scriptural evidence, which in turn expound the following nine principles. Two, Krishna is the Supreme Absolute Truth. This is giving the Dasamul here. Three, Krishna is omnipotent. Four, He is the fountainhead of all relationships and love. Regarding the second topic, the nature of the jiva, the question is whether it is different from Brahman or identical in all respects with Him. Dasamul answers as follows. Five, the living entities are Krishna's separated parts and parcels. Six, the living entity, due to his constitutional situation as the marginal energy, may come under the sway of the material energy. Seven, again, due to his marginal nature, the living entity in the liberated condition is free from the influence of material nature. In other words, here the living entity, the study of the living entity is in three topics. So one is the nature of the living entity, just what is the jiva. Then they talk about the jiva when it's conditioned and the jiva when he's liberated. Because his constitution is, he's marginal, so he could be either. Right? So first is just describing him as being either. You know, what is the nature? Then, if he's conditioned, then it's like this, and if he's liberated, it's like that. Right? So that's why there's three. Because right? Otherwise we say just conditioned and transcendental, but then what defines that he could be? Conditioned or transcendental. Because internal potency is never conditioned. Material energy is never transcendental. Right? Because transcendental means above material energy. So she is material energy. So she's, in a sense, doesn't mean she's not Brahman. But she'll always be material energy. Does that make sense? Concerning the third point, the material energy. The key issue is whether it is created by Brahman, and if it is real or illusory, right? So, in the Nirvishesh and Shunyavad, they will say that there is this basically existence, that there's no quality. Then the question comes on, is the material energy created by Brahman, or is something separate from Brahman? Right? Because if it's separate from Brahman, it's not real, because there's only Brahman. Right? But then the problem is if it's there, how that you're perceiving it, that means there must be something at work there. So then, how would that would mean then the illusory energy is functioning on its own without the support of Brahman. So where does it get that power from? How is it there's another entity that's not Brahman? Right? So they've already, therefore, their monism has fallen apart, because they'll say it's an illusory that it's there, but just that there's something there to even discuss. Why would you be discussing it? If it doesn't have something, it works, it does things. Does that make sense?
So then they actually, they're dualists. We're the ones that says it's non-different. The Lord and His creation is non-different. But not that it's nirvishesh, without qualities. It's savishesh. Right? 8. The living entity in everything in this material cosmos is simultaneously one and different from the Supreme Lord. Right? So we can most easily deal with this. Because it is one, but it is different. Right? Okay. The fourth major question is, what is the means of attaining Brahman, sadhana? The answer is as follows. 9. Pure devotional service is the living entity's occupation and means. Right? Regarding the fifth point, the nature of the supreme goal, the major issue is whether the jiva merges in Brahman, the opinion of the personalist, or retains its individuality in the state of liberation, as told by the Vaishnavas, according to Dasamul Tattva. 10. Pure love of Krishna is the living entity's ultimate goal. Right? So, as you were saying before, is that if you're talking with someone who is, you know, monotheistic, then they'll accept that there's God, there's the world, and there's a living entity. And the world is created by God, the living entities are created by God. So on a basic platform, there's not a problem. Then, through devotion to God, you can elevate yourself, and developing that love for God is the ultimate goal. So they won't actually have any problem with our five basic points. They get it, they can't tell the difference between spiritual and material. So to avoid the spiritual taking on the material qualities, that's when the impersonal concepts come in to their philosophy. And so they can't tell this oneness and difference. So they can't tell the difference between God and the Son of God, you know, and like this. And you know, and then in that there's more confusion. What about the mood between it? So then you end up with a third one. And then there's, well, who does run the place if God doesn't run it? Then you end up with a fourth one. So actually...
Who's the third one?
Third? The Spirit, the Holy Ghost. So you have Father, Son, the Holy Ghost, and Satan. So they actually have four, you know. And then if you say, well, that, well, then, you know, Father, Son, Holy Ghost will be one, but still you have Satan, so they end up with two. So they never, they actually also are dualists. They're not actually understanding that oneness. Does that make sense? But we have to understand the oneness we're talking about is not nirvishesh oneness. It's savishesh. So it's one, but there's variety within that oneness. Not transcendental meaning that it's Brahman, so it is transcendental. But what we're, it was just a play on words that's, you know, being above Maya is that, so we talk about as Maya, so it's there. But she isn't an illusion. Right? She knows she's servant of Krishna. So she's not material. She's the inferior energy. Right? We'll call material energy. But that's because we perceive the inferior energy as separate from Krishna, so it's called material. Though if we see it in connection with Krishna, it's actually inferior and superior energy. And we're marginal. Does that make sense? So the term is used... The material defines our illusory concept of God's creation. Because if it's up to the materially contaminated, if they see spiritual, they'll also see it as something to enjoy. Right? So because of that, the living entity is put into the inferior position in which the matter or the Brahman is not conscious. So therefore it's not disturbed because we're trying to lord it over. You know? You know, if you're sitting there and then somebody comes along and starts looking at you with this idea, wow, I can get something out of this guy, it becomes very disturbing, right? But you can come up and look all you want at, you know, a stone like that, and the stone couldn't care less. So therefore, we're situated in the material energy. Does that make sense? Yeah, so that's the point. Okay, so... Here then we've described the Vedas. Okay, Krishna is supreme absolute truth. Krishna is omnipotent. He is the fountainhead of all relationships and love. So therefore, Brahman is Sagu. Right? And then the jiva Jiva, you know, exists. He has a natural, but it could be conditioned or transcendental. The material energy is also Brahman, or is it, you know, is illusion. It's non-different, but different from the Lord, so it's not illusion. Right? And then the means of elevation is pure devotional service, because you could say, well, we could practice the impersonal path of elevation to get out of the material world, then take up devotional service. You could, but devotional service is already includes that. So there's a non-difference. But then you're engaging in the process in connection with the Lord. What we were discussing this morning is that many times we get so focused on the process that we forget that the goal of the process is Krishna. We're just trying to be good or humble or nice or tolerant or, you know, like this, that we forget why would we want to be tolerant, right? Tolerance has a meaning in connection with Krishna. Like that. Is that what I'm saying? Humble, like, so that's actually the occupation and the means, right? It's what your duties are, and it's your method for getting anything desired. And then love of God is the ultimate goal, right? So it's that. So that's nine. So we notice that there's a tenth one, right? The first one, right? The Vedas are the principal scriptural evidence, which in turn expound the following nine principles. In other words, there has to be authority. Without that, then everybody makes up their own thing, whatever you feel like. You know what I'm saying? Dasamul describes nine principles, pramayas, which are based on the authority of the Vedas, praman, or evidence. The thematic study will show that the mantras from Sri Upanishad are the very same praman mentioned in the beginning of the Dasamul Tattva, Amnaya Praha Tattvam. Thus, Sri Upanishad, which is renowned as the, as, quote, the Acharya amongst the Shrutis, end quote, is the Lord's own answer to the five questions of the Vedantic discourse, and the authority behind the tenets of Gaudiya Siddhanta. Right? It's nice when something can be so definitive, right? You know, instead of saying, well, maybe, so, like, you know, it's like, this is just, here it is. Our guide through these matters will be the Tattva Sutra, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's framework for studying the Vedanta philosophy. Sri Tattva Sutra contains five chapters. The first chapter describes the Supreme Lord, Ishwara. The second chapter explains the nature of the living entities, chit. The third chapter discusses the material nature, achit. These three chapters outline sambandha. The fourth chapter explains avideya, how the living entity should manipulate the material nature in order to obtain the supreme goal, sadhana. The fifth chapter describes prayojana, the nature of that supreme goal, sadhya. After each chapter, there is a summary of the sutras. Whenever appropriate, the sutras and the purports of the Sri Tattva Sutra are connected to the mantras and purports of Sri Upanishad. So the Tattva Sutra is there. It's 50 sutras. So each of these five categories, there's 10 sutras of each. You know, so they're very logical in that. Once Atmatattva was discussing with actually Jaimini Sutra scholar. Because nowadays, you have the six schools, but it's very rare you'll find someone who is fixed in one school, right? Of course, the Vaishnavs or generally the Shankarites are, but others, they have a little mix of this and that, and so this was purely Jaimini. He knew the Jaimini sutras, he just quoted them. So when he was discussing with Atmatattva, he would be quoting the Jaimini sutras, and Atmatattva was using the Tattva sutras, right? Because Vedanta will defeat Karma Mimamsa, right? Karma Mimamsa, Uttara Mimamsa. Karma Mimamsa can defeat all the other four, but Uttara Mimamsa, or Vedanta, can defeat that. So as they're going through, he had an answer, Atmatattva had an answer for everything. So after a while, the man says, what's your framework? He didn't ask, you know, for what is this? He just said, what's the framework? Because he could see it was, so he was just using these 50 sutras. Like that. So it's very, very analytical and very, very well presented, that even other scholars who are on that level of functioning on the sutras, then they can appreciate it. So it's not just, you know, some side work, you know, for, you know, the Gaudiyas. It will establish that. So there's the sutras, and then there's the purport to the sutras. Yes.
Should we understand that this is a framework for study?
How is it the framework? Because this is an analytical study. So, in other words, the these five themes are the themes of the Upanishads, right? So then the Tattva Sutra very clearly breaks down each theme into 10 parts. So then those 10 parts will be connected back to the Ishopanishad to show where it is in Ishopanishad. Does that make sense? Because otherwise then some part will be in one verse and then in a purport or another and another like this, but they'll all be put together in one place. Does that make sense? So, because we're not stopping the breaks, so then we get that in the middle. Start 10:32. Oh, okay, yeah. We'll end at the same time. Jog. You made it, sir. Okay, part one, Sambandha. Topic one, the nature of Brahman. Invocation, mantras 4, 5, and 8, means these four. The invocation mantra, mantras 4, 5, and 8, these four mantras, then deal with the nature of Brahman. Right? So that'll all be pulled together. Does that make sense?
It's in the Ishopanishad.
Yes, means where it's saying there, invocation mantras 4, 5, and 8, that means that's the Ishopanishad. Topic one, that means the Tattva Sutra. Right? Part one, Sambandha, that's just showing the as where in Vastutraya we are. Right? And then as we saw before, he showed the breakdown of the Dasamul into the Vasutrai. So you'll have all those three working together. That makes sense? Okay, is it clear how we're using this? So in other words, the chronological study, then Prabhupada's purports in that give you, you know, a clear idea of what's going on. If they're studied, you can bring out so many things. Acharyas have also made comments on these works. And so then from there, then the chronological study goes, you know, from that perspective. But the analytical, then the Acharyas have written separate works on that. Does that make sense? So on the Gita, Prabhupada wrote an analysis of Gita. And if you've ever gone to the folio and the extra points in the folio, you may have come across it. Devotees come across it all the time. Unfortunately, no one thinks it's a way to study Bhagavad Gita because they don't understand the chronological, the study and then the reading and then the study of the work. Right? So there, that is there. We see that Nectar Devotion, so many acharyas have written books that define a particular point there and expand on it. So there's our analysis of the Nectar Devotion, right? And so then here, because this is on, how you say? It's not that the Tattva Sutra was specifically written for Ishopanishad, it's written for Upanishads, right? And the Ishopanishad is, as I said, the Acharya of the Upanishads. Everyone accepts the Ishopanishad as the preeminent Upanishad. That nobody will dispute that. So therefore, then they naturally connect together. Like Vedanta Sutra is the commentary on, Bhagavatam is a commentary on Vedanta Sutra. Not that they are, they were written in that purpose in mind, but the Vedanta is the essence of the Upanishads. The Upanishads are the essence of the Veda. The essence of the Veda has also been described as four verses. Right, that were given to Brahma. And then Brahma gave that to Narada like this. It comes down, so that's given to Vyasa. He expanded those four using Puranic example, right? Rather than through the sutra method. And so you get the Bhagavatam. So the two go together. Does that make sense? So the Tattva Sutra and Ishopanishad are the same. It's describing the essence of the Upanishads. And so, and Ishopanishad is the main Upanishad. So the two go together. Does that make sense? So it's not directly written here, though we see the other ones are specifically written for that book. Does that make sense? Like Bhagavatam, then the Sandarbhas are specifically written for it. Or Brihad Bhagavatam Rita, Lagu Bhagavatam Rita, all these, they're specifically written as analysis of the Bhagavatam. Does that make sense? Yeah, so like this then is being used. So it's not a unnatural imposition. The personality of Godhead is perfect and complete, and because he is completely perfect, all emanations from him, such as this phenomenal world, are perfectly equipped as complete wholes. Right? This is the invocation. Such a person, the Mahabhagavat described in mantras 6 and 7, must factually know the greatest of all, the personality of Godhead, who is unembodied, omniscient, beyond reproach, without veins, pure and uncontaminated. The self-sufficient philosopher who has been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. Mantra 8. Srila Prabhupada explains the nature of Brahman in his purport to the invocation verse. The complete whole or the supreme absolute truth is the complete personality of Godhead. Realization of the personality of Godhead is realization of all the transcendental features, Sat, Chit, and Ananda, bliss. When one realizes the Supreme Person, he realizes these aspects of the Absolute Truth in their completeness. The complete whole is not formless. If he were formless, or if he were less than his creation in any other way, he would not be complete. The complete whole must contain everything both within and beyond our experience. Otherwise, he cannot be complete. Right. So, because you're looking at it, Brahman, one will think it's just the sat element. But that's the feature. But the point is that the Brahman, or the sat, is the existence nature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So it's not separate from him. Right? It's just looking at only that aspect. You know, it's like if you only look at your foot or something. You know, if we take a cardboard, make a hole, you put your foot through it, and that would bring a bunch of, you know, people, sit them around, and then get out of the little laser thing and start talking about your foot and all that. So people will get so absorbed in the foot, they may forget that the foot is connected to the rest of the body, right? But so the foot at the same time is separate from, right? But at the same time, it's non-different. Does that make sense? So that's how Brahman is. It's Krishna, but at the same time, there's a difference. So, but the complete whole means the person. That's why it says they must factually know the greatest person of all, the personality of Godhead. But at the same time, the qualities they mention are generally the ones that are expected from the Upanishadic view, that he's not material, right? Unembodied, right? So that's why they think he doesn't have a form. You know, he's unembodied means no material form. Omniscient. He knows all things, you know, is there, that's cool. But if he's omniscient, means there's intelligence, there's consciousness. You know, so how would that be discerned? Right? Beyond reproach, without veins, right? Again, the, you know, non-material. Pure and uncontaminated, so because the world's contaminated and impure, therefore he's beyond that. But as before, he's unembodied, so this is where you get the problem. Right, but then the self-sufficient philosopher who's been fulfilling everyone's desire since time immemorial. That means there's a direct interaction going on. Right? And if it's a matter of impersonal, how is it, and he's fulfilling everyone's desire, so that means this interaction here in this world is not an illusion. It's real. Because the Lord, or Supreme Brahman, is creating that. He is the cause of that interaction. You know what I'm saying? It means it's according to the jiva's desire. Right? So the jiva having that desire, therefore the material phenomena is manifest. So if no jivas are having material desire, there will be no material manifestation. But since there's Krishna's unlimitedly expanding, there'll always be jivas who are in illusion before they go back to Godhead. Does that make sense? So the phenomena will always be there. But even if it's not, the material energy still is. Right? That makes sense? Yes? No?
Hopefully.
Okay. So he's complete because you can't have a creation that has all this variety and he not have that. But they'll take it that they're taking that what's not material is superior. But the point is they're missing the point. They're missing the element. How can something come from something else and have more qualities than it has? That won't happen. Right? So that's why they'll say it's an illusion. Because if it's an illusion, then there are no qualities. So therefore, you know, we've worked out the problem. But no, it's here. It's real. It is Brahman. It's inferior Brahman. So I mean, superior Brahman must have all this variety and qualities plus more. Otherwise, why is it superior? If it's equal, then it's not. It has to have more. Right? So whatever we know, God is that plus more. Does that make sense? It always has to be. The nature of Brahman is summarized in the Dasamul Tattva as follows. 1. The Vedas are the scriptural evidence which in turn expound. 2. Krishna is the supreme absolute truth. 3. Krishna is omnipotent. And 4. He is the fountainhead of all relationships and love. Right? So he's the supreme absolute truth. Everything's based on him. He's omnipotent, so all energies are coming from him. And he is the fountainhead of all relationships and love. So that means the energies are interacting with him. Right? Based on they're interacting means relationship, but it's based on affection. Right? So the reason we're suffering is we're not interacting with the Lord based on affection. We're interacting with the Lord based on lust and illusion. Right? So we don't know there's a relationship. Right? And it's the opposite of love. Right? It's lust. So if that illusion or that ignorance that we're separate from the Lord is removed, then you establish your relationship with the Lord rather than with the material energy. Right? And then that love, that lust, because lust is your goal, but the result is for Krishna. So therefore, then that your goal becomes love. Does this make sense? Right? So therefore you see relationships and love, you sambandha and prayojana. Right? So then that means then, yeah, he's a fountainhead, but that means that'll be expressed. So that will be, as we were seeing in Nectar Devotion, that's endeavor with intent to please Krishna because the love is there. Right? Does that make sense? So we can see all of these things, they're the same topic, but just discussed from different perspectives. Does that make sense? You bring out the element of the love or the devotion or he's the omnipotent or the absolute truth. Depending on which one you take, then that scripture will have that particular flavor. But you'll find that there's no difference in all these different topics. Right? Yeah, just wording will be different. So this is Upanishadic, so it'll have, we'll hear much more Brahman, supreme, like this, absolute truth, like this. Does that make sense? That. But if it's, you know, prayers by one of the acharyas, then we might find, you know, something more about peacock feathers and the threefold bending form and like that. Chapter 1 of the Tattva Sutra. So this here is the sambandha. It's the first topic, the nature of Brahman. So here then, it's been brought out with the Upanishad, these verses from Upanishads. So it's funny, this says 4 and 5 and this says 6 and 7, so Something's got to change. We'll find out when the man comes, okay? So then, chapter 1 of the Tattva Sutras. So now this is going through how the sutras themselves go through this, how they analyze it, right? Introduction by Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur. So this is Tattva Prakarana, the truth. Right? This Tattva Sutra is obtained and proven by the eternal realization. Therefore, it can be known as the very essence of the Vedas. This originated from the Supreme Lord, Sri Krishna, Chaitanya, and hence is the origin of all the revealed scriptures, right? So, because we may say, well, every time it mentions about God, it always throws in about the revealed scriptures. It doesn't use the revealed scriptures and then the jivas revealed scriptures. It's always about Krishna, right? So the point is it's he is, how you say, this knowledge originates in the Supreme Lord. So the scriptures are also the point is they're only defining what's come from the Lord. And what they define is these three aspects of the Lord. Right? Does that make sense? This originated from the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna Chaitanya and hence is the origin of all the revealed scriptures. Only the reality has been accepted in this treatise. In other words, dealing with the material phenomena and how you can see it connected to Krishna, this treatise is not dealing with. Does that make sense? Not that you can't apply it inversely to that. That's how the Upanishads work. But the Upanishads only deal with what's spiritual and what's material. They don't get into all the various aspects of material and like that. That's found in other literatures, right? That describe the karma and other things like that. Does that make sense? Like you won't find in here about, you know, marriage or health or, how you say, some other elements like that. You understand? So that's what it means. That only the reality has been taken. Just it's the actual knowledge itself. The other is how you can indirectly connect all these other things back to the absolute truth, based on the same principles. But it itself is not going to deal with that. You have to do it. That's why the Upanishads are there, have all this knowledge. There was the necessity of Shruti, because people, by reading the Upanishad, aren't coming up with all this understanding. Therefore, the Puranas are there to give example of how those who had that understanding applied it in their life. Right? Someone's a Kshatriya, they're married, they have a kingdom. How did they apply the Upanishads in their life? Right? Does that make sense? So, this, being an Upanishadic presentation, won't include those. Does that make sense? But it doesn't mean it's any less relevant. It just means it's, you know, what we'd say, like pure philosophy, you know, like that.
As you mentioned,
give her a bullhorn.
How the academic endeavor to establish some principles, not always in Vedic.
So you
mentioned that in the Puranic, in the Upanishadic view, that would even be considered.
No, because see, as you have paravidya and you have aparavidya, and then you have avidya, right? So the general view, which we'll take, is that paravidya means transcendental knowledge. Aparam means the other 13 books of Vedic knowledge. Right? Does that make sense? The Vedas themselves, the Brahmanas, the Aranyakas, all the aspects of language and grammar, of mathematics, astronomy, astrology, of ritual, histories, logic and argument, Dharma Shastra. They're technically how to engage the material phenomena in paravidya. So that's why they'll be called apara. They're not para, but they're in line with paravidya. They're not separate from. Then avidya means it's not connected to paravidya. Right? So we will say there's paravidya, the transcendental, aparavidya, meaning the Vedas, that are connected to para. And then there's what's outside the Vedas, which will be avidya, because it's not connected to the Lord. So we'll say, well, what if you connect it? Then it's aparavidya. It doesn't become paravidya, it's just apara. But it'll be its connection as it is a connected to apara and therefore connected to para. It doesn't stand on its own. It's not like you can say the modern knowledge and the aparavidya have an equal standing. No, it's the one connects to the other, and then does that make sense? You know. So, but the Upanishadic, because it's dealing with logic, like this, and or I say gyan, so it doesn't get into karma. So all the elements that are karma, it won't get into, right? So they only have two classifications, vidya and avidya, right? Vidyam cha, right? So you have to study, because their point is. If it's not transcendental knowledge, it's ignorance. Right? Because apara means you're taking something that comes from material perception and connecting it to the Lord. Does that make sense? But it's come from the Lord, so therefore it's non-different. It's connectable. but it's not the direct. Therefore, the personality of Godhead interacting with him with that intent, that's actually what's paravidya. That's what's being pointed out here, is that Upanishad's saying is that even you know all this transcendence, still you have to know the greatest of all, the personality. Then you're actually situated. You know, which is fun because they all accept this, but somehow know that they must have some grammatical jugglery that they get out of, you know, the Supreme Person here. But.
So, Upanishad's dealing with aparavidya?
They don't deal with aparavidya.
So, from this point of view, it will be like a blend. From one point, the connected part is para, and the part because of which it has to be connected is avidya.
Their point is that why the Upanishads, basically their point is why would you be involved in the material phenomena when you can directly engage in devotional service? You know, I mean, in other words, it would be taking the principle of why would you be a community devotee when you could move into the temple? Yeah, that's basically the point. Anyone could follow it and apply it, but it doesn't use that presentation like the Puranas do. The Puranas basically are all grihasthas, and there are saintly persons involved. But it's generally from the viewpoint of, most of the time, from the grihasthas. So there's a much broader range of how to connect one, you know, the social elements in one's own life and with everybody else. You know what I'm saying? It's not that the Upanishads wouldn't be used by grihasthas. It's just that they would have to make those steps themselves, while the Puranas will give example of others who have already done it. Does that make some sense? So that's why it has its particular flavor. It's different than like Bhagavatam. Does that make sense? Or even Gita. Even though Gita is Upanishad, but it's presented in the like Puranic context. So you have Arjuna and his emotions and the family and all these different things. Though you can see the basis is Upanishadic. But it's given in an environment that, therefore, those who would be more inclined to the Puranic view would be able to relate to it. Does that make sense? But at the same time, you know, having established this, Jiva Goswami does establish that the Puranic view is the superior view. Because then you have devotees, their interaction, the example, so it's a much better presentation than the Vedantic. But the point is, as far as authority goes, Vedanta is the basis, because it's the transcendental. And all the aparavidya is based on that. Does that make sense? Yeah?
So that's why when you say that if you cannot bring back to the Upanishads, it's not real philosophy.
Yeah. Yes. Because that's what will be the basis. Because your Vedas comes first, the essence of the Vedas. Right? Because we've come back, Om comes through first. Right? From the Brahma Gayatri, which is expanded from the Kama Gayatri, which is expanded from the Holy Name. So on the spiritual side, then these elements of tattva aren't as important. They're on the lower end. But in the material world, they're on the upper end. Right? Because it's a reflection. Because you have to get out of the material world. So that means it brings you closer to understanding the tattva. Having understood the tattva, you can tell the difference between materials. Like if you're immaterial, how do you tell the difference between material and spiritual? As you come close to that center point of knowledge, then you can see on one side the material, the other side the spiritual. Then you can cross from being on this side of that understanding to that side of the understanding. Right? And then from there, then you progress into, you know, the spiritual rasa. Does that make sense? That's what the discrimination is for. Is you can tell the difference between material and spiritual, then getting to that spiritual point, you can tell the difference between material activity and spiritual activity. Right? Because some can tell material and spiritual, but they don't understand activity. Right? Or they understand activity and not spiritual and material. Right? So you have to first make that distinction between the two. Then there is, once you've understood the two, then within spiritual, there is activity. So there's material activity, spiritual activity. So then you're just switching from material activity to spiritual. Right? So that's why the aparavidya isn't actually a problem. Because here the aparavidya is means establishing a pious lifestyle that you can cooperate with God and His creation and not make trouble. Right? So the Shastras give you that. Then it'll show how to connect it to the transcendental. So there's this whole process going on. Right? But you're trying to come to the point of understanding that there's a difference between the material and spiritual. So one will tend, therefore, as one understands that deeper, to move away from the social life and move into the renounced life. Right? Then one will, and in that renounced life, one will therefore take up the spiritual endeavor. Right? But it won't basically look like the material endeavor. Does that make sense? You know, I mean, there's similar elements, but it doesn't have the broad range, because that's why, you know, we're considered tyagis. We reduce down, you know, like that. At the same time, as we're also called pushti, because we nourish, but we're nourishing on that transcendental. We're not using the material as the nourishing. But this paravidya, or this lifestyle that's given, is a reflection of the original lifestyle in the spiritual world. But there it's all directly connected to Krishna. Does that make sense? That reflects here. That's what we want to see. We see the reflection and think that looks nice. We're not looking at Brahman and going, well, that's great. You don't go from the spiritual world to Brahman. No, because the spiritual world already is Brahman. You go from the spiritual activities to material activities. You understand? So that's why we don't have any problem that the Vedic culture being connected to Krishna is a comfortable situation. Right? But because of its so much, you know, that one has to intellectualize to keep it always nicely connected to Krishna, and because in the material world everything being temporary and always falls apart and never gives a great result, there is a point at which one decides not to get too involved. You know what I'm saying? That enthusiasm to engage that the material, the apara, then reduces. You know what I'm saying? It's not so necessary. Like I saw one devotee, you know, just to give an example, one devotee here, he's probably one of the first to have a motorcycle, right? And so he had, you know, big fancy motorcycle for the time and this and that, and then he had it customized and all this stuff like that. And then, you know, going along, and then he has that for, you know, some time and this and that, and long time, like maybe 10 years or something like that. One day I see him riding along on one of these fun little things you buy up at Bamanpakur. It's basically like a glorified bicycle with a little motor on it. And I'm going, you know, what happened, you know? And the point is that it gets you from point A to point B. That's what the other one does, but then you have all this attitude and identification and all that with it. You know, which is, you're looking at the other one, you're just looking at, I need to get over the temple, and I get on this, it gets me to the temple. You understand? So it's just natural, because the other thing is then, you know, all the petrol and all the endeavor, and you have to keep it shiny and always get it fixed and always do something new to it to make it that, because everybody else is doing it, so yours has got to look better than theirs. So all that you give up. Does that make sense? But the essential point of, you know, getting from here to there, that remains. Does that make sense? So that naturally happens if one understands the process. If one artificially tries to, I didn't know how to properly engage all these things in the Lord's service, so now I am doing that, and so now I will say it's okay to be like this, and that being more renounced is fanatical, that's not good. No, I didn't understand how to connect them. I had those needs. So now I understand more how to connect them. So now I'm going through that. And at some point, I'll naturally give that up also. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Along with the accomplishment of the absoluteness of the reality, a doubt may arise that if the reality itself is the universal unity, then where is the necessity of imagining any other object apart from it? Right? Right? So it says, if that's the reality, then why even worry about anything else? Why worry about the variety? For the clarification of this doubt, the word tattva has been qualified as para, supreme. Right. Here it should be, because tattva then means that you're going to have all the delineation and definition. Because if we just say para, it's just all supreme, you don't make a distinction. When we say tattva, it means supreme. You're studying God, but you're studying all the aspects. Right. Here it should be considered that the author has only denoted the divinity by the appellation of tattva. The chit and achit, the sentient and the non-sentient, are called by the appellation of padartha, objects. These chit and achit are enumerated amongst the objects of the phenomenal world. Right? Because, in other words, they're objects, and Krishna is subject. So tattva is the subject. Right? So he's tattva. And then the living entities and the material energy are padartha, or their object. Right? So it's always a relationship between subject and object. It's just a matter of whether you realize that that's what we're discussing or not. Does that make sense? You understand it, then it's spiritual. You don't understand it, it's material. Because of the incomprehensibility of the divinity, it cannot be called as an object. Because an object is something you can see or perceive and then interact with it based on what you would like to gain from it. But because Krishna is beyond, he is inconceivable, he can't be an object. Right? He can only be subject. Does that make sense? So Krishna perceives his energies, so therefore the energies are object. Right? So we're not discussing at this point the spiritual. It also would be padartha, or object. Yes. So it's not that the living entity is being thrown in the material nature. It's just only these two aspects of the Lord's creation are being discussed. Because at this point, we're trying to just establish that there's God and the living entity and the material energy, and that they're all factual and they're all coming from the Lord and related to the Lord. Because other people will think it's all one. Right? So they're not even going to discuss that there's a spiritual energy where all the variety and action and all the interaction and emotions is going on. That makes sense? There's some questions.
Krishna still reciprocates even though we deal with him based on our own needs and desires.
Yeah. But that's subject and object. That's how relationship works.
Yeah.
Right? The subject is performing the activity that is directed towards the object, right? But the activity is based on the needs of the object. You understand? It's what the subject wants. In other words, the subject wants to interact with the object. So the object has a particular need or is in a particular mood. Therefore, you choose an activity based on that, right? So that's why also we go back as the cheshta, or the endeavor, is the most important, because that's where subject and object interact. That's where rasa is actually, you know, experienced. And we're not the subject, and we're technically not the object. Right? We're the assistant. So we're assistant object. Right? So you have superior object, you have inferior object, and then you have assistant object. Like that. That's us. Deputy object, yes, everyone. Improve the status there. Deputy object. What do you call it? PA. The PA object. Personal assistance. Okay. Because of the incomprehensibility of the divinity, it cannot be called as an object. But here, see these words. He's using divinity, right? Supreme, how you say, reality, tattva, para. You use all these words in any, it doesn't matter what the New Age, you know, sabha is. They'll be rolling on the ground in ecstasy because you're pulling out more words than they ever heard of, right? You know? Like that. So This is there. So you see, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, they spoke like this because this is where they were thinking 100, 150 years ago. We think it's all new. This concept of New Age, we call it New Age, it's new to us, but it's always been there. I don't know what it was. I think with World War II kind of ending, after that, or maybe the effect of it, this whole concept of looking to the East and the Oriental and all that being a normal part of any cultured Westerner's life, you know, as some flavor, some additional spice, disappeared. Before that, you know, in the, you know, up to the 30s, 40s, you know, you go into any gentleman's house and he had articles that were from somewhere else in the world. They were from Africa or the Far East or from, you know, what do you call that, Borneo or, you know, some out-of-the-way place. There was this thing and the elements of the occult and all this were things he dabbled in and talked about. Ouija boards were very popular back then, now not as much, right? You know, so all these kind of things were, you know, Ouija boards.
No, it's the exact definition.
Ouija boards. It's a problem. Okay. There's this board, and you have a group of people who are wanting to get some answers, right? And they're not going to look in, you know, Encyclopedia Britannica or something, or go on the internet, right? So they all put their hands together. And then they have someone there who is, I guess, leading the seance, right? And then everyone gets in this meditative state, and then the hand moves around, and it touches on the letters, and then someone else is writing down that, and it spells something out, and then you supposedly get your answer.
The spirit is guiding you.
Yes, the spirit is guiding you. So that's a Ouija board. Where the Ouija board's from, I'm not sure, but... Maybe. I mean, Ouija, it sounds more voodoo-y. It doesn't sound Indian or Oriental. It has more of a Caribbean or, you know, some variety of, you know. Oh, well, enough on Ouija boards, but do we understand the point? So before it was more common, so... This idea, we're thinking, oh no, this is a whole new thing, and what the Acharya is saying, what Prabhupada is saying, doesn't actually apply. No, they started off talking that. Because when we go through this, it kind of goes over our heads, because this is the stuff that, you know, is for going over their heads, you know. So they just want something really, it sounds, they catch, but the thing is there, it's reality, it catches. And then as you've caught them, and they're so happy with that, then you bring it down to, you know, you're going to surrender to Krishna and chant Hare Krishna, you know, like that. Does that make sense? If any word mentioned expresses some meaning, then that word can be called as pada. And the object denoted by that pada is known as padartha. These objects lie within the reasoning of human beings, but the divinity is beyond the human reasoning. Right, so it means word mentioned expresses some meaning. That word is called pada, and the object is the padartha. Right, remember before we were talking about the ultimate cause and the formal cause. So in other words, it expresses some meaning, which is the ultimate cause. But at the same time, is then it is the form that you see. So that becomes padartha. Yeah, because the Lord is, He is pada, but padartha is that which can, is object, that's what can be perceived. Right? In other words, the Lord, He is quality, and that form that manifests that quality, that's padartha. Does that make sense?
So that padartha is potency within and above that which you cannot see.
Yes. Yes. In other words, yes. Like you said, the Adi Bhuta, that's padartha, right? And the jiva is perceived. But the Adi Daiva, that is actually beyond. We have a connection too, but he's actually beyond. So he's not padartha, right? He's the origin of it. So he's pada. He is what is actually being expressed. So that means the jiva and the material energy is actually expressing their relationship with the Lord, or that that connection with the Lord. Does that make sense? Yes.
So would Pada refer to principle?
Yeah, basically. Some meaning, then that word can be called as Pada, and the object denoted is Padartha. But you still, there's going to be some subtle difference here. You know what I'm saying? Because they're trying to establish between what is Tattva and what is Padartha. Right? So Tattva is going to be the Lord, the subject. Because Tattva is subject, what you're discussing. And Padartha is the object. So the relationship is between Tattva and Padartha, because that's the question. You have Brahman, what's the relationship of the Jiva is Padartha with the Lord? And the material energy is Padartha with the Lord. Yes?
Those words, Tattva, Padartha, and Para, are referring to which text? Because
they don't... This whole text that we're reading now, this is Tattva Sutra.
But why he's taking Padartha and Para and explaining these words?
He's why these words?
Yeah.
As opposed to...
It seems that he's explaining some sutra which I cannot see. I'm asking or
give us about 5 centimeters. Okay? For this reason, the Supreme Reality is known as Tattva and not as Padartha. The Supreme Lord is quite distinct from the phenomenal objects, but no object can have its essence separately from the Supreme Lord. Right? So in other words, he is the essence of the Padartha. You can't separate. They're different, but at the same time you can't separate. It means he is everything, so there's a non-difference. And the Padartha can't function without the Lord, so there's a non-difference. But still, he's the Lord, Tattva, and there is the Padartha. Right? The Supreme Lord is quite distinct from the phenomenal objects, but... Okay, we already read it. This fact is evident from the realization, though not understandable to the human logic. Right? So the point is that just from logic... See, one way to say, no, but if it's actually pure, you know, without any emotion or that, we should be able to understand it. But the point is there is no such thing as material logic. There is a logical way to express your mundane needs. Right? But there isn't a material process of logic that's separate from their mind. Right? Like the scientists will say, well, you can't see God, he doesn't exist. But that's only because they have an attachment that God doesn't exist. Right? Because if God exists, that means then the laws belong to somebody. And I'm actually, instead of working independently, I'm actually working under someone else who's already established the laws. So there's already an emotional attachment there. So it's not actually logical. Right? It may follow a more systematic form than someone else who is just varieties of emotions coming out in different ways. So it's systematic. But it's still there. Therefore, he's saying is that it can be from human logic. Right? From transcendental logic, yes, but not from human logic. Right, so that's why it's realization, because realization means you've already accepted, right, the spirit, right? Like in Gita it says the spirit. In other words, that within the Sambandha, the aspect of Prajumna, right, where we understand, have that desire to work within our relationship, right? Shankarshan is there, we have the interest to work within that. That will give rise to Prayojana, which means your realization. Right? Because you have your understanding, but it's the realization. Right? So it has to come from that. So it's the same as what Gita is saying. Right? So the introduction of Gita says that, the introduction to Tattva Sutra says that. It's not going to function another way. We may like it to or say it must work, but it won't. Because we're saying it must. Why must it? Why it work? Because we're the one that establishes it? No, this is the way God made it, so it's just the way it works. Therefore, in this topic of reality, the first aphorism has been established by the author as follows. Interesting to note, when he says the author, he means himself. But he's because he's written the book and then he's written the introduction, so it's like a commentary. So he's talking about, you know, like that. I even think Vyasadeva uses that when he's in Vedanta Sutra. He'll even use Vyas says this, and he's the one writing it. You know. It's common. It's not understood in the Western literary field, but it's there. So it's very common that they'll write a book because it gets all the essence, but it needs explanation, so they'll write their own commentary. Right? The modern is you write the commentary and the work all together. But then the difficulty comes is if you want to expand on it more, you have to write another book. So someone may read the first book, may not, may make the connection between the point made in the second book and the first book. But if you have, let's say the sutras, there's 50 sutras, you write a commentary, then, you know, you don't, it's not a separate work. It's right there. You can directly see it. Now let's say later on, either someone else sees that there's more that could be added. They can write a commentary and it goes right in. So you see their comment, the original verse, the commentary of the original author, and then this. So then you see them all together. So it's very efficient. You can keep adding. It doesn't matter. Right? Like you can have there's a book published that has Bhagavatam with all the commentaries of all the acharyas. It's not a problem. You don't have to write a separate book. But in the modern, you would have to write a separate book. So they can't understand why would they do that. But it's actually, literarily, extremely efficient. Right? So here he's written the introduction after writing the sutras.
It's also nice to write about yourself in the third person.
That's there, but they're doing it just so that you don't get distracted, because the topic is the actual point you want to get across. Who the author is, this, that, it doesn't matter. You know, so I'm saying he's writing it like that just so that you won't get distracted by it. That's one of his expertise. We could say one of Bhaktivinoda Thakur's expertise is how to cut through the mundane covering of the doubts and misgivings of the individual living entity and get right to the essence. As I said, that's why you can take this and go into any sphere, and you know that values kind of intellectual and you know, something to do with something higher. And this will work because it cuts through. It means up to now we discussed all that. No one could say there's nothing there that militates against any world religion, right? Any specific philosophy or this, things like that. There's some aspects they could try to play with, but basically it cuts through everything. So that's what he's very expert at, is how to avoid getting caught up in the issues. Like we saw last year, we could hit on a point that we could go through very shortly, but if someone, it was an issue for someone, it could drag out for hours or weeks. Right? Because so he was very expert at cutting through all that. You know, so if we use this, it works very nicely. Like that. Okay, Sutra 1. Okay, we've accomplished the 5 centimeters, so here it is. Ekaf paro nanya. Okay? So here you have paro. Okay? The supreme reality is one without a second. Summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary.
Okay, so here.
Yes, the introduction is, I think, as it is, but here this is this means, in other words, the commentaries must be quite large. So he's taken more the kind of essential points out of it, you know, and so that's done. So therefore, it's the summary of Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur's commentary. Yes.
Can we get the full Srita
Pasutra? It's generally available around. You could probably look on the internet and find it. It's not a big work, but it'll be bigger than, you know, probably what we're doing here.
Yeah.
You know, so. But the thing is there it's not going to connect back to Ishopanishad and those things. So that's the... The Supreme Lord alone is the supreme reality. No other object can be realized as the ultimate reality. Okay, well, that's it. I thought it was going to continue. Nope, that's it. Summary. Yeah, so well, that's 20 pages, but we cut it down to... Okay, so he's the supreme... nothing else. In other words, what you can perceive cannot be the ultimate reality. Oh. I forgot this class is shorter. Yes, otherwise we'd have a problem. Yeah, it just perfectly fit in. Okay. So then tomorrow we're... No, tomorrow? Today. Today's... Yeah, tomorrow then we'll continue with the second one.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna. We have some serious footnotes in the next. Footnotes bigger than the point.
What is our homework or home study?
On this, I would just say read this and be familiar with it. Because this is, you know, we're... You know, in other words, if there's anything that doesn't understand, go back, look at the Ishopanishad, the particular mantras that are there. And those purports, and then, you know, from here, then that's because then that'll be more clear, because then the essays will come up, and you know, then you'll be more prepared, because this is the kind of thing is that, you know, by more reading you become familiar with the terminology and the approach and everything, so it'll make it a lot easier.